Okay, well, if you'll just start over, the students would appreciate it.
I will.
Thank you.
So this is a 51-year-old Caucasian male. He's at work, he starts getting dizzy and nauseated and feeling really weak, and he's having chest pain. So his coworkers called 911. Now, EMS people, put an IV in, they give him two nitroglycerins, put him on 2 liters of nasal prong O2, and transfer him in. Blood pressure's 98 over 45, which, as I told the group here, you need to calculate what that mean is, because mean arterial pressure is perfusion, and we want it to be 65, so everybody's perfused. Heart rate's 110, respiratory rate's 28. He has a blood grade 10, O2 sat's 95. His EKG that we get as soon as he rolls in, remember we've got 10 minutes, we get that EKG. It shows that he's had an acute anterior lateral MI. So, negative Chanelle, what kind of MI? What part of the heart is affected by that type of MI?
Left ventricle.
What chamber is now?
Left ventricle.
Thank you. Left ventricle. And the heart rate was 116, so he's sucking up a lot of oxygen, or that's another one. So we're looking at ventricular dysrhythmias as being a real risk here. Right? So we're gonna have our mind thinking ahead, what drug, if he starts having couplets, triplets, short ones of V10, because we know he's had an MI.
Right.
So if he has any PVCs, we're gonna take note and get ready to give
amiodarone.
Anyway, so we're going to emergency medicine wise. We've already started on nitro, morphine. We also might want to think about and anticipate them, because he's had ST elevation, if you look at that rhythm strip, his ST segment is way elevated, so it's a STEMI. So we have our priority actions of getting him ready to go to cath lab. So we've got our IV, we're gonna get him, we're gonna go through sample, find out if he's allergic to anything, especially shellfish, and get ready for that. We're going to make sure that when he had his last meal, what medications is he on? Did he take them that morning? Or when he was supposed to? Those are important questions as well. Because some of those drugs will have to do something. Like if they are on Coumadin, and they took their Coumadin this morning, what's the problem now? It's going to take us a while to get hemostasis, because now we're going to have to heparinize them during the cath. But anyway, so he's going to the cath lab, door drug within 90 minutes, and we'll need to get him ready for that. Now, an hour later, any questions on that from Alec or from Nagish? So you're up with me on Mr. We didn't give this guy a name, Mr. No Name. Now, what do you expect? What's the expected outcome after the angioplasty PCI? What do you expect to see, or I should say, not see, with his EKG after a successful angioplasty?
No ST elevation?
Tamara, did anybody know what they need to see?
I said no ST elevation.
The ones that lowered ST segments.
Yes. That's right.
That's all what right. We said too.
Okay, an hour later, the CCU nurse notes bilateral Graves. His pressure is now 92 over 46. Calculate the mean. Heart rate is 116. O2 set is 90. What now? Mm-hmm. What's happened? What might be happening? He has RAS, pressure's down, heart rate's up, O2 sat's down. Heart failure. So what lab would you recommend?
BNP.
That's right. Now, what are you going to do? We'll talk about it in just a minute. It's called unload fast. Now, the monitor alarms and the rhythm below is what you notice. And after saying the word before, Jameson, but not for loud. Okay, so what now? We have the rhythm that's on the left, lower left. What's that rhythm?
B-tech.
Allie, what rhythm is that? Alexander, what's that rhythm on the left, lower?
B-tech. B-tech.
So what are we going to do?
See if you want to call for help. Get a crash cart. Defib.
Get ready to defibrillate. So what are we going to do while somebody's going to get the defibrillator for us? Or defibrillate. And what dosage are you going to use?
Give it
Epi. Are you going to go full on 360?
Oh, 200.
Yes. Yes. You could. And some people do it.
For the shock, it's 200, 300, and 360.
Unless that's changed. Sandra, have you taken any CLS recently? Because they didn't change a few standards.
I'm going to need you not change it because you drilled it into us in the last 2 days.
I don't know. I was thinking it was still 360. Yeah, that's reason. I don't know.
That's really
good. 2, 3, 360. Okay, so we should go and check the pulse. Then look, what are we going to do? We're continuing CPR. Flush it with.
Can
you CPR, circulate that, and then do what?
Chest compression.
Defer that again, 360. Then I'm
going
to start CPR. And then I'm going to give them ADO rub. 150. And I'm going to circulate that. And then I'm going to defer that again. Now, what am I going to say? Or what am I going to do with safety before I hit that button?
Clear.
Because I'm standing over here, and the patient's over there, by the way, clustered with all kinds of respiratory people and other nurses. I'm going to say clear, clear, all clear. And I'm going to look around and make sure that Jimmy Bob over here is rolling his iPhone while he's bagging. But anyway, yeah, that's the biggest safety thing that we want to make sure. After the treatment, now he does go back into sinus rhythm. The MD orders amiodarone to be starting at 1 milligram for 6 hours and then 0.5. Now, why is that? We just gave him 300 and then 150 and then 300. It's a maintenance. You got to keep a blood level. Same with lidocaine. Or we'll be back in that, doing all that over again. So you want to be sure and figure out that dosage, okay? That's homework for you. All right. And that is a bad day in the life of a MI patient, but unfortunately not uncommon.
So let's wrap up. The rest of the stuff?
We have two things to do. We're going to talk about heart failure and cardiogenic shock.
Ms. Baxter, can
yes.
you ask her if we're doing the last
six lives?
The last life.
Six lives.
What are you asking me?
If we're doing the last six lives of this.
Oh.
There she goes.
I forgot. I forgot to add on some of the major complications. I don't want to think about the complications.
Well, don't put it on the test.
All right.
Just keep going.
Oh, we got some questions at the end, too. Sorry. All right, so complications are going to be with the drugs themselves. We're going to be having problems. We're going to have to, with many of these people, anticoagulation is going to be important because atrial fib comes into the picture sometimes, especially with riots. And ventricular dysrhythmias with the other. So there will be times where you'll find those drugs will have to be employed. But dysrhythmias related to reperfusion are common. And what would you call this, by the way, that little rhythm strip? What would you document that as? You could put it that way. Any other options? Now remember we said you name the predominant underlying rhythm first, generally. So what's this underlying rhythm? You only have two beats to look at. It looks like a sinus beat is there, so I call it a sinus rhythm with a four-beat run of BTAC, or a short run. Some even call it a salvo. I don't know what that means, but anyway. Very tight glycemic control. We want to make sure that we do attend to that, either if, whether they're diabetic or not. Certainly if they're diabetic, we're going to have to address that, because we've got to control that to control atherosclerosis, right? So that's the complexity of these patients, is to make sure we don't just hone in on the heart and forget the rest. Number one cause of heart failure patients is renal failure, by the way. MIs, dysrhythmias, is the number one cause of death, followed closely by congestive heart failure, cardiogenic shock, which we're fixing to talk about. They also can have papillary muscle dysfunction, ventricular aneurysms, and a couple of others, pericarditis and Dressler's, and then pulmonary emboli. Now, here's the issues. Pericarditis is relatively common after an MI. It's inflammation of the pericardial sac, and y'all talked about that in patho. Pain is the inspiratory pain, especially, is the most common, along with a pericardial friction rub. So if you don't know what that sounds like, you might want to go on YouTube and listen to a pericardial friction rub. It's a very grating kind of sound. And sometimes to hear it, you have to ask them if they can to hold their breath to distinguish whether it's a pericardial or a pleural friction rub. But it usually is pretty easy to detect without even doing that. They're going to treat that with aspirins or NSAIDs, ibuprofen, Motrin, something like that. But that's a risky business now. As you know, the recent thing is showing that the use of ibuprofen and Motrin increased heart attack risk, so, and blood pressure. So, but it is a short course, so if they do use it, it's usually just a very short course. May cause pericardial effusion if it's a larger, but mainly it's a complication that can, it will seal itself off. We just have to support them. Ventricular aneurysm is supportive, but many times surgical correction ends up happening. This is where there's the pressure within the left ventricle, that remember that you have that dead space, dead little spot. So sometimes that will begin to thin out, and it will, under the pressure in the left ventricle, will bulge out, creating an aneurysm as depicted here. And that's going to cause a problem because it's with especially cardiac output. It bulges until some of the systolic effort is completely stolen. I mean, I don't get it. That stage 3, stage 4 ejection is not accomplishable. So they'll have some clots in the left ventricle. So that's a problem. And they'll have to surgically correct that with an aneurysmectomy. And it's like open heart surgery. I mean, it is bypass. Or it's not, yeah, it's not a bypass, but it's surgery, cardiac surgery. There we go. Ventricular septal defects. Now, this is when you want to really, remember we said you report a new onset systolic murmur. So you want to really be sure that you report that, because these septal defects can be corrected surgically, but it needs to be done ASAP. Now, if it's a new murmur onset from capillary rupture, they'll still need to go to surgery, but they can't get a stable enough to do that, so many times they do succumb. But then septal defects, they'll have chest pain, syncope, hypertension, and that new onset murmur. So it's a medical emergency. They need to be put on vasodilators to reduce afterload, balloon pumps sometimes to support them through surgery to correct the septal defect. Papillary muscle rupture, and if you remember, that's the muscles that's holding the valves seated, and a sudden new onset murmur is a medical emergency, just remember that. And surgery is where we'll try to get them, but it's unfortunately, it's a very rare thing for it to completely rupture. And the MIs that lead to that are usually so significant, anterior lateral MIs, that their prognosis would have been poor anyway. Wall rupture is the same way. All right. Y'all ready for heart failure? Or talk about it? Because that's next on our agenda. Trying to get there a little quicker, but that's all. All right. Y'all y'all talked about this before, have you not? In second level, did y'all talk about heart failure?
Yeah.
This means yes, this means no. You just talked about it? Good.
Good.
Then we'll talk to her again. Let me ask part of this shot. Now, the heart failure, I'm hoping I can remind you two things that might be worth focusing on, at least for ACI and certainly on our test. It is where the heart's just failing to do its fine record, which is to keep enough oxygen and enough perfusion to the rest of the body to provide the oxygen needs. And, or the urge of this, or having to pump at such an elevated pressure that it begins to fail. So if you do it for a while, in other words, put it past this point. Remember the Stirling code that Denise talked about. If we push that stroke volume up and keep it up, now just short-term increases may not put them in full down failure. The message is chronic overstretching of the ventricle, which puts them on the track for heart failure. It is the fastest increase in heart disease, second only to pulmonary hypertension in the nation now. Very biologic spin trying to overcome this. The sad thing about the statistics still remain within 10 years of diagnosis that they will succumb to this. And there is a classification. Did y'all talk about the New York classification? One is usually in heart failure, but is completely able to do anything they want activity-wise without shortness of breath or chest pain and maintained on medications. It phases into step-by-step, and it's in your textbook, New York classification 4 is the so-called cardiac cripple. Those people who can't even go to the bathroom without having chest pain. Literally, they cannot walk from their easy chair where they live to their bathroom without having chest pain and shortness of breath. Intense shortness of breath. Usually hormone 2, and many of them are home vasopressors like dobutamine or Nurofen. So they're only, most of the New York 4s are not options, not candidates for heart transplantation. So it describes activity relative to the disease. But importantly, it's used as a communication between caregivers and researchers. When they're doing research on certain populations, they usually spell out what New York classification they have. And if you look, what happens with the cells is the myocytes, because they are overworked, they hypertrophy, just like any muscle. So the chamber gets thicker, more muscular, and larger. Now this picture shows it looking like it's smaller, but the chamber itself also expands. So that's going to translate into a greater filling pressure. On any given day, if you put a swan, put a catheter into someone who's got heart failure, the numbers are going to be higher, acceptable numbers. They're going to be fine with a single pair of 14 or 16, because their one atrium is also sometimes, or at least their left, is hypertrophy. And their PAD, pulmonary artery diastole, is going to be high, because they've always got excess lung water. Every bone of their day, they've got a little bit of excess lung water, which is kicking up that pulmonary pressure. Y'all follow me? I know it's been a lot. We're almost done, so hang in with me. So just remember, heart failure, big floppy heart. Okay, remember big floppy heart. It's flopping around, it's all stretched out, it's trying to do what it's supposed to do. The factors that lead up, which you can probably know very well, coronary heart disease, hypertension, diabetic disease, congenital heart defects, we talked about those last time. A lot of those kids move up to heart failure. In fact, that's the ones I've seen with COVID more than any population in the adult world. Infections like endocarditis and myocarditis, endocrine imbalances, diabetes, mellitus, of course, 6 to 10 times more. Pregnancy, the 10, I can count on my fingers. I think the last time I counted 15 labor delivery issues that ended up in the adult ICU. And probably 6 or 7 of those were due to pregnancy-induced hypertension and how fast it had developed in very young women, and the right ventricle just couldn't deal with that, so they went into right heart failure very quickly. All of them, except for one, survived, by the way. Dysrhythmias, renal failure, musculoskeletal disorders, autoimmune diseases, systemic lupus, rheumatoid especially, pulmonary embolism. Now they go into right heart failure very quickly too with pulmonary emboli. And then anemia. Now, why would someone who's anemic, chronically anemic, like down into the 70s, with anemia, why would they be at risk for heart failure? They're not going to be oxygenated because they don't have enough red cells, right? So who's going to pick up the pace? The heart. If they weigh 400 pounds, One of the things with working with morbidly obese is you'll know, you'll recognize if you do your homework that their physiology is very different because of the mass and the burden that's put on their heart in trying to oxygenate that mass. So very quickly, we have 30-year-olds that die of heart failure because of that. And finally, bacterial endocarditis. So the pathophysiology, there's two types, systolic and diastolic. And it's going to create, the systolic has the weakened muscle. They can't eject. That's the most common, by the way. Diastolic heart failure is where the ventricle itself is very stiff and non-compliant. That's relatively rare, but they can't fail because it just won't stretch out. It's just like it's fixed. So cardiac output goes down. Compensatory mechanisms that are used to maintain the cardiac output are employed, but they become a problem too. You remember that? So myocardial myofibers lose their recoil, cardiac output goes to failure, so it becomes a spiral downward. And this, I think, it shows the big floppy part better than the other picture. But here's the compensatory mechanisms, and why I want you to walk out why they're a problem. These very things that the human being does, the human body says, okay, we can't deal with this new arterial pressure at 50. It'll just stay working for anyone. So the first thing I'm going to do is pick up the fire flap. I'm going to get some norepinephrine, and I'm going to do a couple of things. I'm going to vasoconstrict. What's the problem? I'm going to get a better mean pressure out of that, but what's the problem now? Well, yes, it's still down though. But what's the problem with vasoconstricting the arteries or the veins? Less blood flow. Remember, supplying demand. Neurohumoral response is where the renin-angiotensin system comes in. Women, more fluid, more vasoconstriction. More of a problem with the mismatch, right? Maturated hormones are also part of that process as well, with sodium being retained in their fluid, and more work on that left ventricle. Now, the hypertrophy of the muscle mass, this is something I want you to appreciate. Here's normal slide on muscle fibers. You guys seen this before? Here's normal. Here's what happens over time to that big floppy part, or in that big floppy part. Look at those myofibers, how smooth. They have multinucleated areas and intercalated discs that are really well defined. Next step is a little bit of hypertrophy. And now we have intercalated discs that, now what do those do anyway? They speed up normal conduction. That's right. So now we have a delay that may be occurring because of those intercalated. And look at how big those myofibers are. And we have 3 nuclei here, now we have 2. And a whole lot of fat. That's just adipose tissue. Third, even worse. This is cardiomyopathy, where it's completely stretched out, where there's very little form left. So I think I told y'all the story of my first heart transplant and seeing that heart just fall into that. It was amazing. And I've been using that metaphor for years of a big floppy heart. And that's what ventricular remodeling is about and why it is so dangerous. So why do you think we give ACE inhibitors? Why do you think we give metoprolol and beta blockers? Trying to tone this down. Yes, they need a little bit of compensation, but they don't need a lot for a long time because it's going to make a situation worse and worse and worse. Diagnostically, we're going to look at the history and certain EKG and enzymes. Those both will be awry because it's not unusual at all for someone to be in heart failure and to have, oh, by the way, a new MI. Because his heart is struggling to keep up that fine directive and he just can't move. Chest X-ray, echoes, we're going to be able to look at the ejection fraction. What's normal ejection fraction? 50 to 70. So if it's less than 50, what's that tell you? And they're not getting completely on the tissue level. Echoes will also give us LVP, which is the best thing we can get. If we do a left heart cath with that swan, we'll be able to tell exactly what the amount is left after the hospital in the left ventricle. It's the same thing with the ejection fraction, basically. In the later studies, once we get them compensated, when they first come in, they're decompensated. So what's a decompensated person look like when they go through and look at all these tests and stuff from the same one? But here's a picture of that big floppy heart. I think when we showed that on the other day, here's a normal heart. Like she said, you can just at a glance look and see and measure it all. I learned it first, their first, not yours, but look how big that one is. This is tiny in there. There's probably a little bit of rock out there or pull from off. This one is pure wax. Look at all the infiltrates. That just makes us long water. We can't pump it forward like it's supposed to, so it's backing up. And that's basically what heart failure is. The pump is failing, so the pump, instead of going this way, it's going back. So if it's left, where is it backing up to? From the left ventricle, left atrium, to the wrong. So wouldn't surprise you, gee, the first sign is cough and shortness of breath. Now, if it's right heart failure and it's backing up, it's going to back up from the right ventricle to the right atrium, subclavian, spiroduodenum, and then back down to the liver, that area, to the end of the fat ankles and the rock and has room. So here they are. Here's the memory tools you know at the end of it. Take them, pull them out, cut them up if you want to. Left side is left ventricle, hypertrophy, corruption, shrink. You're going to have crackles or rash, whatever you want to call them. But there's any crackles in their bases usually. Be sure to listen to it carefully. When they decompensate, you can hear them. They're out of their mouths. I mean, you can hear them without their stethoscope. And that tells you they are drowning. Mm-hmm. So what drug would you anticipate giving?
Diuretic.
Lasix or Vuma. It's gone. I have a little bit of dyspnea or apnea. Escary heart tone. You know, that tells you very clearly that there's some failure here. Now, what are the labs would look for? BP. Greater than 100? Yep, they are. Greater than 900? You better step on the gas and elevated PAD, low pressure. If we were to put a swan, all that excess lung water is going to come to be right in our face. They'll have PADs that are 24, 28, or higher. Right side on the other hand, there's your question, left side. He's going to be tripod, coughing, exertional dyspnea, cyanotic, paroxysmal nocturnal dyspnea, all kinds of short breath, right? Mm-hmm. And elevated blood pressures and blood thin sputum. Remember that frothy thin sputum? Where do they get that from? The back part pressure from all that stuff in their alveoli causing this foam to develop. So it's foamy, and it's under such unusual high pressures that it's kind of breaking up some little small capillaries in there, so it ends up having to. So it's just part of the pathology that you understood, I'm sure, it's part of that. JVD, now, the hepatojugular reflex is where you press very gently around the liver, and you'll see that jugular vein just wave up, and it is over. That's what that is. But usually you can tell by the jugular vein distension, you don't need to know the hepatic vein. Hepatomegaly, splenomegaly, bowel pulses, oliguria, dysgluminias, and elevated CVP, which is what the JVD tells you about. The thing we recognize is ascites and big angles to the right side. Now, it can be acute or chronic. And what we often see, unfortunately, and we're fixing to do it, our final swan song is another case study that you can do on your own if you'd like, but I'd like to take a look at it as a group. Just the, we won't answer all the questions, but anyway, I'll show them later. But if you, after an entry level MI, you know, might as well just go ahead and set your clock and be watching for this and thinking about it every hour and looking for the signs. If it's caught early, treated early, we might be able to keep them alive until that ventricle can somewhat recover. So those are the ones that will go into acute heart failure without too much time passing. So the acronym, have you all heard of unload fast? You see that? There it is. We'll go right to the end. Chronic, there's hyperemia over time. It just is a steady buildup. If it's acute heart failure, let's say someone has a left ventricular anterior line, and it's not huge, and they recover from it, from the MI. But remember, atherosclerosis is not the thing. And let's say they, you know, just happen to be one of those unlucky people who do all the things that they should do. They take the medicine, they work out, they do their exercise program, and do all those things right. But that process is still going to go on that I showed you with the ventricular hypertrophy and remodeling, even with sometimes even with ACE inhibitors. But we hope it doesn't, and the jury's really pretty good about it not happening. But anyway, it can become chronic. So if they have structural damage, with hypertrophy, with dilation of chamber, and those are the ones that will come back in the ER fairly consistently with exacerbations, CHF exacerbation, where they always have a little bit of excess lung water, but now they've got a whole lot. So it's like this backup, even though they take the diuretic and doing all the right things, it's going to back up because it's a progressive disease. Unfortunately, heart failure, as is any heart disease, is progressive. And there are lots of things we can do to keep it from progressing rapidly, but over time and with age and other types of issues, it's probably going to get worse before it gets better. Anyway. Signs and symptoms, fatigue, weakness, dyspnea, shortness of breath, exercise intolerance, y'all know those because you talked about it before. And oliguria. Now, why would oliguria make us go, what? Kidneys. The number one cause of renal failure is heart failure. The number one cause of death among those with renal disease is heart failure. It's reciprocal. So it is something to watch, and that's going to lend them toward multi-organ involvement. But from the heart perspective, it's a real bad thing as we watch that BUN creatinine slowly go up and the GFR slowly go down. Because we know we're losing our easiest and best grip for treating this. If the kidneys have gone south, Lasix and Bumex aren't going to work. They have to have 25% GFR for the thyroids to work at all. They have to have at least 20 to 25 for LASIKs to work. And then, you know, I've tried to find out that LASIKs and Vumex will work sometimes when LASIKs don't. But that, what I'm saying is if your kidneys, we have to keep your kidneys, or then we're going to dialysis to try to correct the fluid issues. And that's a bad, that has its own can of worms jumping there. So here we are with optimized cardiac function. So we might end up adding in, other than just aspirin and Plavix and the drugs that we talked about, or Carvedilol or something, we're going to add probably something that will be an inotropic agent. Maybe ditch, but we have to watch that real carefully because how is ditch clear? Kidneys. The kidneys are slick, can't do it. But the ACE inhibitors have certainly stepped in. So here's your acronym, your memory to it. For treating congestive heart failure with decompensating. Upright position, that's the first thing you want to do, stick the head of that bed so they can breathe. They're drowning. So that's the first thing you can play around with is increase the head of that bed. Nitrates, you're lower preload and afterload. LASIKs, preload. Oxygen, increase their oxygen. If they're drowning, I'll take care of the COPD later. But we sometimes even have to intubate because the pulmonary edema is that severe. Digoxin is a maybe because we do have to get a blood level of it. But this is really a chronic situation. So ACE inhibitors, IV, can be employed a little quicker sometimes. And we end up on both. Fluids, we're going to decrease those. Now that means keeping TKO IVs not at a TKO rate, but just flush every shift, right? They're not the ones we're going to have a 25 milliliter IV going just because. And similarly, we also can ask the pharmacy in collaborative practice, let's see what the minimum amount that some of these drugs, the IV drugs, can be put in. The standards are there for safety. But if you're looking at, let's say, dobutamine. Dobutamine as a standard comes 1,000 milligrams and 250. Well, let's call and see if we can reduce that, we can increase that concentration and safely deliver it. Same thing like with Bank. We traditionally put Bank in 250. But if we've got a central line, and we most of the time will with these folks, we might be able to concentrate and give it over a longer period of time, that 4 to 9 minutes, in 100. You see what I'm doing? And just kind of concentrating. Sometimes you can, sometimes you can't. And that's where the pharmacist, that PharmD gets to be really good with helping us decrease the amount of overall IV fluid these people are doing. Afterload, we're going to decrease with what? How are we going to decrease afterload? Beta blockers. Now, we can only give those when they are compensated. When they're drowning, when they're full of pulmonary edema, is that the time to give them a beta blocker? It would be good if it was just preload, afterload, and heart rate that reduces, but what else do they reduce? Contractility. They need all they can get right now. When they're stabilized and compensated later, then the studies have shown that to add carvedilol to their drug regimen increases their lifespan as well as their quality of life. So they are most all of them put on carvedilol, low-dose carvedilol, once they've been compensated. So we're going to also do a diet restriction of sodium and put them on the, what kind of diet? The DASH, but you need to be sure and review your foods, okay? The question is not going to be what kind of foods, answer is sodium. You need to be able to help them figure out what kind of foods. If they're low people, I don't know, they're not dietitians. Test, ditch level, ABGs, K level, all those tests that we talked about. Now, is there anything I've overlooked? They might need some inotropic, you know, oftentimes they'll come into the hospital in full-blown pulmonary edema. So they may need milnerone, dobutamine, some of those inotropic agents. Promoting rest, providing nutrition, and supplemental oxygen occurs in the stretch. Nursing problems can be major activities while they can't do a great thing without being sure of breath on the chest pad because of the increase in oxygen. All the cardiac output, and it could be related to quick load, it could be related to the after load, with the left ventricles having to work against. Certainly it could be heart rate if they're extremely to get tachycardic. The hardest thing is to look through and consider it separately because our interventions are different. The other problem typically is a decrease in contractility. So we're going to be looking at things like dobutamine and Novalone and digoxin IV, and then maybe some ACE inhibitor as well. Dysrhythmias are going to be treated with amiodarone, lidocaine. If it becomes atrial, like AFib, they can use clonazepam, metoprolol only when beta blockers only when they're compensated. Same thing with calcium channel blockers as well, modified. Anxiety related to unknown prognosis. They're going to be going under a lot of tests, and that really goes for all the populations that we're talking about now. MR as well as whatsoever. Powerlessness, there's nothing worse than knowing that this is happening to your body. You're already getting older and thinking, I have no control. I mean, that's just something that's hard to. So, getting them into cardiac rehab again will give them a support system. That really is important, I think. Heart rate for thromboembolism. They may end up in atrial fib. Very often they do because of the involvement in the atrium in having that excess lung water in the left atrium is going to make them very prone for atrial fib or atrial flutter. So that's why we have to also sometimes add some type of anticoagulant to their profile. Once they're compensated, and if their BNP is not in a severe range, they can be, they can be cardioverted, but it's a real risky business because it's hard to get them to not clot because of that big change. Anyway, common health promotion, we're going to be looking at medications activities. And do's and don'ts and add another D for the DASH. Remember that DASH diet is a good way to kind of start framing out. And you know, the thing from teaching diets is to not write it from the negative, like you can't have this, you can't have that. Flip it over and start talking to them about what they can have. You know, and they can do that without spending a lot of money. It just means being creative. But be really careful because my mom, who's 95 now, they told her she was a borderline diabetic. So between the time she was passing and the time that I saw her, I was asking her about the, you know, the cooking on diet. I said, okay, what do you eat? Well, they've given her this written diet plan, and she was eating the same thing from the time she got up to the time she went to bed. I mean, she'd been eating the pork chop every single day. I'm not kidding, it was the same thing. It's like, and that's what you have to remember. They're not stupid, they're just simple. You know, they're trying to do what they can, so you need to be sure. If you can't do it, get somebody else who can. Collaborative thought. Pulmonary edema is life-threatening heart failure, and I'll talk about that in a second. Other onset can be very sudden. Called flash pulmonary edema. This is a slide. All that space, that's water. So they are really well. Some of the symptoms are tripod, extremely anxious, distant, they're quite blue. Diaphragm, audible rumbles that you can hear from outside in the hall. Respiratory acidosis from that tachypnea. But it will go into a, first they're alkalotic, then they become acidotic. So usually the flash pulmonary edema too fast for you know that problem. So once you get blood gases, you're usually looking at respiratory acidosis. Foamy, that pink, frothy sputum, that's fulminant, or really bad, pulmonary edema. And the treatment again is to unload fast. And here's an X-ray. If you look at this X-ray, there's all kinds of things that's looking for.
with that big compartment. It looks like there might be a garment or a tissue or some kind of care part of the nation. It's a second layer of tissue or something for some reason. So how do we treat this? Well, they need some offloading. Big time offload. What's really cool is like this. I've been in a situation where in outside this country where we had someone in coming to Lima and had no license. It's a miracle. Cardiomyopathy is very right airway heart failure. We should talk about this in a second, rather. It's really a very difficult disease. It can come about from a number of different sources. It can be viral. It can be idiopathic. It can be as a result of numerous MIs, you know, one MI after the other. However it happens, both chambers, this is a picture showing it before, and there's two major types. There's one that's fully dilated. That's the most common. And you talk about a huge floppy heart. It is just flopping around there. Both chambers are failing, and it's very difficult to they're doing the same protocol as heart failure, but usually with some right heart failure support as well. Maybe even some Viagra, but they're pulling up attention. But they're, it's not, it has a different name, it's totally steroid. Ventricular, the other one, which is called hypothetic, is on the right. It's very rare, it's usually genetic, and that's where that left, that muscle layer just gets big, bulky, and fixed. So they become stretched. But that's rare. The most common is the dilated. And the most common thing we do is a heart transplant. We used to do them here. They're very common in Houston and in larger cities. The biggest problem is donation in the life of others. Cardiogenic shock is complete heart failure. We talked about heart failure, so think about heart failure on steroids. Is not just allowing backup, it's not moving the heart rate control, it just can't. It is so stretched out, so diseased, that it's basically failed. So this is a concept north of what happens, especially in as an end or as an outcome complication of an MI. MI, myocardial dysfunction, from the systolic side, there's decreasing cardiac output, decreasing sweat value, hypertension, less perfusion systemically as well as to the cardiac muscle itself, more ischemia, and as you see from the arrows, it becomes a circle down the drain. Very high mortality, 72 to 84, because in these cases, most of the time, supportive measures include ECMO and transplant. There is a shock state, and the real underlying problem is a decrease in tissue perfusion. The heart just can't perfuse. Can't be fast enough, strong enough, or thoroughly enough to support tissue perfusion. So the body goes into anaerobic metabolism and anaerobic acidosis. Now, early, they'll be in alkalosis because they're breathing so fast to try to make up for the excess lung volume. But they'll end up in an acidotic state pretty quickly. So lactic acid builds up, and that's going to create a two-fold problem. Not only the acidosis and its toxic effect on the other tissues, but also it neutralizes the effect of catecholamines, like norepinephrine and epinephrine. So that's going on. Meanwhile, we're trying to oxygenate a lung full of water, so you can understand why it's really important to get on something like ECMO. Or impeller will do the same thing, but we're just buying time till we can get them transplanted. And some, as Denise mentioned the other day, some of them are candidates, some of them aren't. Unfortunately, the coach that she was talking about, and I haven't heard if he's still alive, I think he is, but he was 51 and had a huge anterior lateral MI, was put on ECMO the next time. Yes, he's put on that note and CRT. And they shipped him, and I wish I'd been there when they actually transferred him, but to be thinking about having to transfer, being the flight nurse, flying the spouter and all this equipment, and all this big, important connections, because if they decamed like in that moment, that would be within just a few seconds. So anyway, it does have some people survive, but live in a real circle. Picture in your mind somebody who is on, and these are the signs, it's really just heart failure, really, really bad, fall out of the hospital. But does have some criteria. When we first look at the criteria, like, well, that doesn't sound too bad. But the criteria of systolic pressure is, systolic blood pressure is less than 90 again. And I had to put the less than word on. Less than 90 for at least 30 minutes. Heart rate is greater than 60. In organ hypoperfusion, and I finally got it right, urinary less than 30. So we start seeing multi-organ dysfunction because of the acidosis and because of the consistently low mean pressure. The heart just can't keep it where it needs to be. Cardiac index is less than 2.2 with a wedge pressure greater than 15 consistently. And this I got out of the internet. I tried to find some really cheesy pictures of them. We don't have anything that we but we're going to use fluorocinol and butanidine. We're even putting on CRP to try to offer sort of a preload. Vapor ventilation to keep them oxygenated. Correcting the constituent parts. Aha, that's easy to do. Right? Not. Left heart failure, especially after a big MI, just going to take time. And we sometimes don't have it that time. Cardiac output support measure. So we've got somebody that will probably be on, this is just picturing in your mind, they're going to be on that mode, they'll be on CRTT, they'll have epinephrine, they'll have norepinephrine, both usually norepinephrine, and maybe norepinephrine as inotropics. They'll be on normal to help with their inotropic for cardiac output. They'll be on, sometimes we go from injections of Lasix to a Lasix infusion, or a Buramax continuous infusion. We may even mix it with mannitol. So what I'm hoping that you'll see is it's Katie Barbara. We're trying to keep them alive. And that's all we can do. We're going to be shot, so really. It's very, very nice. Now, there's a lot of people, like the news that I also mentioned, there's a lot of people walking around with ventricular assist devices, and that's an option too. A bad, a nail bad, that ventricular assist device, and they actually have bivads too. Biventricular. I mean, it's kind of a scary thought. The nurses on 2S at last night have done this, have managed these patients. I don't know what's changed about their program, but anyway. So the cannulas, they have the same cannulation on ECMO, but the cannulas are internally motivated, and then they have a small pump that really just sits, it's like a phone pack. That's where their battery stays, and they have their external drives. And they're bringing them around the cabin. They need to make sure their battery stays good, so they always tell them to have an extra battery on. But you'll learn more about airbags in clinical practice, especially if you're less conscious of that program. But that's an option to, again, have some quality of life if they get to that point where they can. Any questions? Here are some things that we can do, and some other YouTube videos that I ran across. Do y'all need a break? We're not quite done. No. But almost. Let me make sure I can, yeah, that's the finish. I usually put up the slide at the end.
Right.
But I want to look at this.
12:30.
Go ahead and take a break, but let's plow through. Is this going to take long?
Not really, but you're telling me.
Aren't you the girl that I gave you online? Yep, we're going to go for it.
I'm dead. Wait.
It won't open. It might just be.
I think this case study's been a lot.
Is this the last thing, a case study?
I think so.
She said it with nothing.
Which one? No, that's the funny part. All right, I can't get mine to pull up on the computer. Makes me mad. Let's see if I can do it this way. Open in a new link or a new window. Oh, there we go. All right, this is a, and I want y'all to do this really quickly. I know y'all want to get out of here, so wake me up again. I want Alexandria, I haven't heard anything from you guys, questions or otherwise. So y'all get to look at and go through day one at 10:35. At 11, Magnus, you guys are going to take over with someone acting as the reader and the class helping them answer the questions that are on the test or on the quiz, as well as
who's going to be the reader
that I asked. Then Shreveport,
Caroline, you want to be the reader?
Y'all get from 12:30 on.
Y'all want to just check out
the same day?
Yeah.
Alex
can be the reader.
You get to admit this guy at 10:35. And at 11 o'clock, we're going to turn it over to Magnus. And then at 12:30, Magnus is going to turn it over to Shreveport. So what y'all want y'all to do is go through and look through this and tell us what are the problems. What's going on here? And there's some questions that you can briefly answer. And if you don't know the answer, you got a group to work with. Okay, so I'm going to give y'all about 5 minutes to look through this because you're the ER nurse, and how much time do you have to do this? 90 minutes. We're not going to spend 90 minutes.